While I'm asking both speakers to join me at the table, I just will try to summarize what we learned in this session. So I think Dr. Stemwinkel, he teaches us that CKD is a stage of accelerated aging and that we steadily but slowly are unraveling the underlying pathophysiological mechanisms. Second, Dr. McIntyre, he showed us new insights on how perfusion of key organs like the brain, the heart, the liver, and the large intestine, how this may be disturbed in CKD, and how a simple measure like cooling of the dialysate could have a major impact and improve this organ dysfunction. And finally, we learned that quality of life is something which is very important. It's related to outcomes, and I think we as nephrologists, we should take our responsibility and try to improve quality of life in our patients on a daily basis, I would say. Having said this, I invite all of you to come to the microphone, state your name and affiliation, and I think both sessions are open for discussion. Peter?
First, let me thank everybody, all three speakers for their really, really amazing talks. I have a question for Dr. Onuru. The possibilities for pervasive sensing devices is increasing virtually by the day. There is, devices like Fitbit, Apple Watch, Jawbone, name it. They are really coming to the fore and they're used by millions now. So we got really interested in deploying these devices to our patients. And we ran a little study on that. So I was wondering what's your view on these pervasive sensing devices? Do you think they have a play a role in the future management of patients? Do you think they could provide valuable information with respect to certain domains such as sleep quality, physical activity, and others?
No, that's a great question, and I think they will, whether we or our patients want them to. I mean, Apple's collecting data on all of us right now, and it's going to segregate the data out by sort of major health condition. I think that the caution I would have with these devices would be sometimes the results are counterintuitive. There was an abstract we presented at ASN maybe 3 or 4 years ago where we looked at our actigraphy data, which is data you get. I had been using it to study sleep, but you can also break it out and look at physical activity. And what we found was that older patients who are on hemodialysis are the most active on their dialysis day, right? And yet they tell us they're the most fatigued. And so that was somewhat puzzling, surprising, and hypothesis generating. So it may not always be so intuitive. I think that I guess I would say that the devices have a large potential as far as monitoring physical activity and nutrition. I think that the use of the devices to monitor symptoms will be a little bit more burdensome, and the interpretation of those data will be problematic. There are studies in chronic health conditions using cell phones to collect frequent data from lung transplant patients, and that data is then fed forward to the care team. In some cases, this seems to be useful as far as picking up flares. And so I think in ESRD, it'll be very interesting to see how we can integrate this data. And that was actually one of the topics that Dr. Maddox raised in a recent review he wrote for Seminars in Dialysis, sort of how we're going to use these technologies going forward to improve the care of our patients.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Yep.
In the back.
What quality of life scale do you think is pragmatically usable on a frequent basis in ESRD patients? And is that QO, I presume we're all using the same quality of life scale from Kodokal. Is that the mandated to be the only scale to use?
So it turns out that it's not mandated that it's the only scale that we use, but it adheres to the guidance provided by CMS. And so if you use the KDQOL-SF, you sort of meet the common standard. And so everyone's largely adopted that instrument. I would say that those instruments are useful at the population level for demonstrating change, or the absence of change in our case, but they're probably not that useful for the individual patient. You know, when you think about the issues of reliability that you get into with scientific measurement, the KDQL-SF probably isn't reliable enough to guide individual patient care, and it kind of gives us an idea on the population scale where we stand. I think on the individual level, I think that we'll see more sort of targeted survey collection, like for depression, functional status, that sort of thing. And I think we will be responsible for improving those outcomes and then indirectly responsible for improving quality of life overall of our population.
Where do you think the scale is going to take an individual or a group? Because they're never going to be as good as they were at a GFR of 30 our goal is, okay, we can extend your life.
Yeah.
And if we start too early, it won't improve your quality of life. And
right.
If we start later, it'll improve a little bit for a while.
Yeah, do we have sort of a floor effect in that people are already so low we can't bump them up, I think is a valid question. Because it's not only dialysis. I mean, people bring a lot of other baggage with them to their unit, right? Their diabetes, their amputation, that sort of thing. But I do think that there is evidence that as nephrologists, we can improve their quality of life in a clinically meaningful way. And I hold out the FHN trial as an example of that. You know, if you look at the primary outcome of FHN, it was physical well-being, and that was improved with more frequent dialysis. The unfortunate thing is that no one wants to pay for it.
Thank you. Roberto?
Yeah, Peter, that was a very nice talk. When you look at elderly patients, there's a group of elderly patients or individuals that would have lower GFR, and the other ones, even though they are much older, they would maintain the GFR. Has someone actually looked at these markers that you've been talking about in this two subgroup of patients and compared them to see if the kidney function in the elderly might be increasing or accelerating the aging?
No, to the best of my knowledge, this has not been done. Aging biomarkers has not been systematically tested in renal patients, to my knowledge. I'm sure there are a lot of low-hanging fruits to be picked there if one starts to systematically evaluate the effects of treatment. For example, we are currently doing studies looking at the effects of renal transplantation on aging biomarkers, and the effects of different dialysis modalities, treatments, and within patient different groups, like you allude to, it's not been done.
In the back, right? Yes, thank you.
John A.J., Long Island University, New York. Dr. Peter, you had mentioned earlier oxidative stress, telomere erosion contributing to aging. We know that free radicals are produced from the foods we eat, and especially the Western diet due to highly processed foods that we get. So you have a lot of free radicals. My question is, how does telomere erosion occur with what we eat?
To be honest, I'm not aware of any studies that evaluate the impact of different nutrients, the quality of nutrients on telomeres. What I'm aware of is that studies show that the telomere attrition is a dynamic feature and you can have an impact by, for example, physical exercise. I have not seen any study that have in humans that have checked if different diets could have an impact on telomere nutrition. And that is, of course, for reasons that these are cumbersome studies to have a long-term diet to be followed in patients. But it's certainly a very interesting idea to evaluate this.
Thank you.
Takir Karim, I have a question for Mark. Socioeconomic status, especially in third world countries, developing countries. you know, we live in a world of recession, and Uncle Sam, like here, covers for dialysis. But in other countries, you know, somebody has to sell their land, their homes, and everything and come to dialysis. So do you think these are confounders if you were to assess quality of life, measuring those scales?
You know, it was sort of interesting at the Kate Eagle Controversies Conference. That was a very major issue as far as how we should word particular things, given the sensitivity to the differential resources available to folks across the developed and developing world. I think that also the wording of regarding conservative management was also very cautious, in that we didn't want to give any governments an out so that they could say that an international controversies conference didn't, you know, advocated for no dialysis in folks, that we tried to avoid at all costs. And I think that, you know, it's not only dialysis, but even the treatment of pain is going to be varies by country as well. And so I think that what you have is sort of a reflection of the history of sort of treatment of chronic illness. I guess in a review article maybe 5-10 years ago, we outlined how our expectations for treatment have changed, right? It's gone from simple survival to having a certain functional status, right, with measured by a Karnofsky score. And then it has gone to a sort of health-related quality of life parameter, and now maybe it's even more a patient-centered approach in the U.S. So I think your point about areas of scarce resources is a very valid one.
Thank you.
I have a question for Peter in the meantime. Peter, you show data showing that phosphate is really important with regard to aging. Is it serum phosphate levels which is the most important, let's say, driver of aging, or could it also be that the phosphate intake is important? Patients and healthy people, I mean, the serum levels don't get up when they eat more or less phosphate. So there's some kind of you have to make a distinction between serum phosphate levels and dietary phosphate exposure. Does this make sense with regard to the aging process?
I would think so, but I cannot say for sure. But I'm pretty sure that if you have a diet that give you a high intake of phosphate, it's also an indication of that your other lifestyle factors are not optimal. So there are a lot of confounders there, but and it's been shown that it's a socioeconomic issue in studies from U.S. that poor people tend to have a much higher intake of phosphate. And, of course, processed food, which is, I think, more common in patients with low socioeconomic status, will increase the phosphate intake and phosphate absorption. So, again, there is no real evidence, but just an incentive for more studies, yeah.
Okay.
I have a question for Dr. Stenwinkel. In the study you are conducting now on aging, are there any measures with respect to stem cell recruitment, stem cell regeneration? I'm asking, I was really impressed, I think it was data from Anne Haynes, where they showed that the ability to discriminate different smells, was associated with outcomes, apparently because in the olfactoric bulb, it's one of the only area where neuronal stem cells are actually regenerated. And I was wondering if there's any measure of stem cell regeneration in your in the study.
Yeah, I recognize that study of the olfactory function, which is maybe the most sensitive measures we know of our stem cell function. And regarding stem cells, we are aiming in that direction. We are trying now to study stem cells from the kidney donors and see if we can get that to work. And then if it works well, we also start with the kidney recipients there.
Okay, thank you.
A final question in the back.
in the relationship of phosphocation and progerin and ESRD. Vascular in ESRD, it's not a calcification of the vessels, it's sort of some ossification and there's actual structure of bone there. In the progerin patients and in ESRD, is there differential vascular phosphification, such as the lema, which seems to survive pretty well in ESRD patients in bypass? Does that not phosphify as much as other vessels? In the progerin patients, do they phosphify all over? Or
well, there are so few of these patients, you know, so we lack a lot of data because they have not been studied in detail. As far as I know, they have an segmental aging syndrome. That means that some organs age very quickly, whereas others do not seem to age. And what it's evident that their vessels are exceptionally prone to premature aging, but I have no data if there are different degrees of calcification in different parts of the arterial tree. I have not seen any such detailed studies.
Okay, thank you. I think everyone is hungry and willing to have some food. I thank the three speakers for the excellent talk. I will also thank you for your questions, and we look forward to meet each other again at, if I'm correctly, at 1:25. Thank you.